Meredith. The next speaker is Ida Heather Bird. Talk is entitled Wachinye Didane, Equitable Partnership in Language Revitalization Movements.
Okay, so hi everybody. Like he just said, my name is Ida Heather Burge. I'm a PhD student at the University of British Columbia, and I'm going to be talking about reciprocity and equitable partnership in language revitalization movements. I'm looking specifically at the community that I've been working with quite a bit, Tlingit, and the ways they think about reciprocity and starting to build off of this really community-based understanding of understanding of ideas of exchange. But first, I think we need to sort of step back a minute and sort of go through the ways in which academics and Indigenous communities have interacted with one another previously, currently, where I think we ought to be going as academics and also as community partners, and ways in which I think we should get there. And so in thinking about this, we sort of have to step back a little bit and understand why some of these tensions are still there, and where these tensions are coming from between communities and academics who have not always been so kind in their interactions with Indigenous people in particular. So Indigenous people globally have endured and continue to endure genocidal practices that include physical, psychological, and spiritual abuse on a grand scale, murder, blood quantum practices, both externally imposed and more recently internally incorporated, enforced sterilization work toward the goal of physical eradication, boarding in residential schools, citizenship requirements, and overt and covert racism attempt to break people psychologically, and the outlawing of ceremonies and language create spiritual rifts in the community. Often this lived experience is described by academics in terms of colonialism, and often colonialism is spoken about in the past tense, yet these experiences are not located firmly in the past, however we much like to believe they are, because for Indigenous people, such as my grandfather, and also my adopted family, colonialism has never stopped, and I think we really need to continuously engage with that thought that colonialism has not stopped. There's been no point where these practices have officially ended and appropriate healing has begun. Instead, these practices have simply changed forms. And so this conversation is talking about how those forms have changed and ways in which we can address those forms systematically to really build equitable partnerships in the way that a lot of people in this conference and a lot of people who've been working with communities for a long time talk about really wanting to do. But first, we need to recognize that colonialism is not an abstraction. It is a reality not just for Indigenous people, but for all of us, wherever we find ourselves in society. I bring this up first and foremost because it's something that we must continuously acknowledge when considering academic research, Indigenous peoples, and equity, which is what this paper or this talk addresses. It is not enough to assume that because mass murder is no longer prevalent, although if you are an Indigenous woman, that is a matter of debate, that we have evolved past discussions about reciprocity. For Indigenous people or those in the academy who have been a part of an Indigenous community for a long time, this is not novel or groundbreaking, it's simply fact. For others, however, and I'll talk about some of those others, many of whom find themselves in positions of power to granting agencies, positions of power for tenure or accepting talks for a presentation at a conference, a strong and continuous reminder might be necessary. So this talk reflects on four questions. First, where we were in the past as an academic community in relation to Indigenous speech communities and our work with Indigenous languages. Second, where we currently are in terms of those relationships. Third, where I propose we think about heading. And finally, how I propose we should get there as a community and as a society. If this seems like a tired or irrelevant discussion, let me respond with two thoughts. First, while much has been written in regard to linguistics and anthropological's role in colonialism and its growth as disciplines, nearly all of that background literature has been written by academics, typically white, with little input from the very groups with which these articles attempt to reconcile. Second, we as scholars have an ethical responsibility to continuously grow. That is what makes good people, but also good academics. Academics are people too. This discussion is meant to give space for reflection on language revitalization movements, the communities we are a part of, and those that we work with, and how our goals can best support everyone involved. We have work yet to do, so let's get started. So where we were, it should come to know as no shock that during the birth of both linguistics and anthropology as respective disciplines, academics were, in a word, awful toward their indigenous counterparts. A brief read-through of works like Malinowski or Durkheim attests to researchers' thoughts on their indigenous consultants. There's a lovely quote about savages up there. We won't spend too much time on that. But phrases like a product of their time comes to mind, as scholars of that era were not alone in their particular brand of thinking when it came to savages. For young indigenous scholars getting degrees in these fields, like myself, these are often seminal works that have to be read, respond to, and incorporated into their work, our works, in order to be successful academically. These are not just works that are acknowledged and then dismissed as inherently racist, but works that are foundational to these fields and are continuously referred back to. We as the Academy believe that these things are somehow salvageable, and perhaps they are, from these scholars and these writings, and perhaps that is true, but we also recognize or also necessarily require that our indigenous counterparts, our indigenous partners, confront, if not accept, a distorted image of themselves or other communities within the academic literature. Assad, if any of you are familiar with Assad, 1973, reflects on the birth of anthropology and arguably linguistics and its connections to power, colonialism, and inequity, and he is far from the only scholar to do so for anthropology or linguistics. Often, as Anderson 2016 states, this turn from overt racism, racist scholarship to a more humane approach to research begins in anthropology, at least with Boas and his students in the 1900s. Jan Anderson also points out that Boas and his circle were not the only ones to focus or to force the discipline in a better direction, with works like W.E.B. Du Bois and Zora Neale Hurston sort of being swept aside. This idea of thinking about indigenous groups and indigenous people did not simply disappear after Boas's rise in the 1900s, however, nor has it entirely left us academically or societally even today. There's another scholar, Mar in 2017, who speaks to this very point as an indigenous academic himself. So the LSA, the Linguistic Society of America, is currently in the process of drafting a statement on race. While this is largely in response to linguistics' role in labeling language practices of racialized communities as inherently deficient, it also recognizes the lack of diversity in linguistics itself. Similarly, for the past 3 years, a breakout session within LSA has focused on Native Americans' roles in linguistics with the aim to foster better relationships, so things are happening, if not slowly. Yet still, trust between Indigenous communities and the Academy has been broken. Years of mistreatment, unethical behavior, stolen objects, and stolen languages have made many communities rightfully distrustful of outsiders coming once again into their nations, and even now this trust has yet to be repaired. Exchange of goods in returns for information, guidance, or translation works are sometimes documented, sometimes not, and just as likely the exchange, if there was one, was not equivalent anyways. See Nabokov for a number of Indigenous accounts on exchange. Accounts of linguists creating and then taking material to be locked in an archive or written in such a meta-archaic fashion as to be indecipherable without a PhD are very easy to find. Many communities have had enough, and any benefit to relationship with the Academy, be they an individual or an institution, is always weighed against the potential threat of losing more time, resources, or knowledge than they are rightly gaining. With years of tension behind us and a shaky foundation to begin with, where are we now as far as an academic community in relation to our Indigenous partners? Today, it is common practice to compensate elders or fluent language speakers with an honorarium of some sort or a contract of X amount of dollars per hour, anywhere from $25 to $45 has been my experience, typically lasting the life of the grant or the project. Typically, although this is slowly changing, that project was designed, administered by, and directly benefited the academics and the Academy in general. Of course, this is not always the case. Today, ethic review boards in general require a letter of community support for a project before being given approval, ensuring that at least someone from the community has seen the proposal before it was okayed to go forward. As many know, however, this process is far from perfect, with ethics approval requirements often tailored for medical test subjects and not written for social science work, which is often more nuanced and typically involves less blood taking. This in turn leaves things like consent forms to be written or administered in an often paternalistic fashion. It can be challenging to develop a relationship grounded in trust with a fluent speaker when you have to ask them to sign a 10-page legal consent form every time you speak with them. In an effort to keep vulnerable populations, and this was pulled from the TCPS, safe from unscrupulous researchers, things like ethics reviews and approval become less of an opportunity to consider equity or morality and more of a legal loophole to jump through with as many or as few provisos as possible. Still, this has encouraged scholars to consider what benefit their work will have for the language community, agreements to leave copies of data collected or to design in the creation of pedagogical materials or to assist in the creation of pedagogical materials to support language community revitalization efforts are becoming more common. These forms of compensation for community time outside of honorarium are usually written into the grant proposal themselves, though they are not always discussed with the community beforehand. Active partnership building, however, between language communities and academics is still relatively new. While scholars have individually built relationships with the community, it's only been recently that universities and funding agencies are starting to formalize these types of partnership building processes on an institutional or a university to government or tribal and band level. In Canada, for example, the SHRC partnership grant, which was launched in 2015, sort of attests to this shifting idea about community and institution relationships. It is a direction I feel like we continuously need to head and expand on, which sort of leads us to our next session. This quote is from an abstract reviewer for this particular conference, suggesting that honorarium for 40 years has done away with this idea that we need to be thinking about reciprocity. So where should we go? Monetary compensation is just not enough. Providing records of data collected or grammar produced is not enough. Creating pedagogical material without input from the language learning community itself is not enough. Acknowledging the importance of traditional ways of knowing as potentially useful to our narrow understanding of language culture and our place in it is not enough. This is not to say that all the above is not important, because for many communities it certainly is. For many communities, it's the bare minimum to work with them, and that's fair enough. What I mean is that these gestures alone, for me as a scholar, are no longer just enough to be considered to do good work. Much like the semanticist who's unable to make good grammaticality judgments without context, and much like linguists in general who are recognizing that people and culture are part and parcel of a complete study of language and can't be separated, we as researchers can no longer afford to believe that we are engaged in an unemotional business transaction, a robotic exchange of goods and an extraction of what we as scholars find useful while leaving the rest in return offering a token in its place with no real concern for whether it was actually useful information or not. For many, it has not been acceptable for a long time, but for some, like the reviewer highlighted in the quote at the slide before, it is just how things are done. Unfortunately, anonymous reviewer number one is not alone in that particular way of thinking. So where do we go? I suggest we challenge our assumptions about our roles as academics and as researchers and acknowledge that many Indigenous communities, there's no such thing as being a passive observer. We are either in or you're out. And when it comes to language work in particular, which is directly connected to both trauma and healing, to do good research, you need to be in. I propose then an Indigenous community-based framework of reciprocal research that is attentive to language revitalization needs, community concerns, as well as academic investigative interests in the academy and the academic as a human being. The question is, of course, how to do that? So how we should get there? It is my belief that the answer to incorporate reciprocal practices lies within the communities themselves. I can almost feel many who have been reflecting on this process for a long time sort of rolling their eyes and like, oh, you think? Yet again, this continues to be a conversation that is lacking in academic literature, and for young scholars like myself, as well as for older, less adept at changing college, it bears repeating. The communities in which we work and or are from have thousands of years of reciprocal practices and protocol that facilitate exchange between individuals, exchange between groups or nations, as the case may be. These practices are often with varying degrees of accuracy in anthropological literature, and language use surrounding these practices are similarly documented in linguistic literature as well. While Indigenous elders are far from are a far more reliable source of information surrounding reciprocity for any particular community. I point to written sources to show that scholars have been aware of reciprocity and community practice for nearly as long as the disciplines themselves have existed. Yet little work has been done to consider research and researchers' role within these practices. This is, of course, again, slowly changing, particularly as more Indigenous people become academics in these fields and more attention is paid to other forms of scholarship. So, the community that I work in know somewhat the best, and there's a couple of Tlingit people in here, so they are more than free to correct me. The wheel, as I understand it, or as we understand it, doesn't need to be reinvented. As many people working with or from Indigenous communities will remind us, ideas of reciprocal relationships are already well established. I'd like to speak for a moment on what I am beginning to understand about reciprocity within the Tlingit context. So Tlingit, for those of you who don't know, the Tlingit Nation is part of a matrilineal, moiety-centered clan system, with coastal Tlingits being born either Raven or Eagle, and inland Tlingit people typically being born Crow or Wolf, with some exceptions. Being born into one moiety or the other is automatically considered, the other moiety is considered your opposite, and there's a great deal of respect and responsibility towards one's opposite moiety. Quote, two main features characteristic of Tlingit culture and oral tradition, ownership and reciprocity, popularly called balance, is what Dick and Nora Downhower wrote in their Tlingit oral literature work. So the Tlingit term for this concept of both tangible and intangible properties, a'u, and a'u is what one typically is exchanging when one is reciprocating to keep balance between moieties and between relationships in general. The most canonically ceremonial reciprocal exchanges in Tlingit would be considered the kuik, or the potlatch. Tlingit, even within a memorial potlatch, what is being given, taken, and reciprocated, most importantly, doesn't seem to be the physical, although the physical objects are themselves quite important. Potlatches are often called payoff parties for a reason. They're reciprocal affairs meant to once again balance the scales, acknowledging the opposite moiety's time, strength, and assistance in transitioning through a period of grief. The opposite moiety to the clan member who has passed has been assisting in the death rites since the beginning, holding their grieving opposites up, and a potlatch is an acknowledgement of that help. Traditionally, several members of the opposite moiety washed the body, combed the hair, painted the face with the deceased crest symbols, and wrapped the body. While the duties of one opposite's responsibility to the other have changed over time, the responsibility of supporting an opposite moiety member during the grieving period is still there. One way in which that support is expressed is through speeches during the potlatch, and this is what that quote speaks towards. So a'u then is most important in Tlingit society for its intangible aspects. So speeches, stories, and time spent with one's opposite relatives are exchanged, and responsibilities, even outside of ritual death practices, structure one's interaction with each other. Who is born into an obligatory relationship? One is born into this obligatory relationship towards others, but is also gifted with that same sort of supportive relationship in return. And while this is an incredibly brief and rushed glimpse into Tlingit worldview, it is quite often applied by Tlingit people to those who are traditionally outsiders to the process. This is a process of ceremonial adoption within Tlingit society that allows, and at times requires, that individuals be sort of brought in to a moiety, given a name, maybe subsequently carrying all the responsibilities as well as benefits of being a community member. So researchers, legislators, outsiders who's married a Tlingit individual, as well as students, myself being one, are often incorporated into this reciprocal system by such a method. It is, as they say, a big deal, and it is precisely because Tlingit people feel so strongly about reciprocity that they bring people into the system to keep things balanced. This idea of a reciprocal research is so important. Impartial participant observation, which connects with anthropology's scientific identity struggle, as impartiality in science is so prized, is impossible, particularly within a community that refuses to leave anyone outside of that system. Of course, Tlingit is not the only culture with this strain of thinking, but they're a good example of how potentially culturally insensitive a researcher could be interacting with a community in which there's a strong expectation of equivalent exchange of services, be that assisting with the deaf or taking a fluent speaker's time. Intellectual property like a'u intellectual property is at U and highly valued, it's necessary that that value be recognized if a balanced and just research relationship is to be established. Again, this applies not just to tangible goods, such as those indicated in Moss's The Gift, but often much more ephemeral acts, such as bearing witness. Payment might be made in physical objects, but also in a much more weighty exchange, like giving gifts, responsibilities, or praise. I argue that research, with its relationship building, language documentation and creation, and central humanness, falls squarely into this concept of reciprocity and exchange. The outside researcher, as an individual, but also as the face of a department, a university, or an organization, and often as a face of an institutional system that was instrumental in the particular language's currently dire state, partners with another individual who themselves are representatives of their clan, tribe, family, and ancestors. Not all communities or indigenous groups will have the same reciprocal structure in place as the one I've outlined, and that's okay. More important, I think, is to consider that practices have already been developed and how research can and should be part of that system is already in existence. Linguistics and anthropologists have historically had an issue with decontextualization of communities, languages, and belief systems, and I suggest that instead of attempting to continuously extract information and present it in this academically and unbiased format, that we consider what an incorporation of context might look like. This is the process with which indigenous scholars have already had to contend. Research for some, as Wilson states, is ceremony, but not for everyone. It should be incorporated into the same, but for everyone, it should be incorporated into the same cultural structures of reciprocity that already exist in whatever community the partnership is being built. The wheel has already been invented. We as academics would do well to acknowledge that it's already there and participate fully in whatever way the community calls us to. Science alone is not the greatest good. Thanks.
Okay, we have around 8 minutes for questions.
Yeah.
It's not really a question. I want that printed. I want what you just said printed on our wall. So I work at the Center for Native American and Indigenous Research at the American Philosophical Society.
Okay, yeah.
I'm not going to talk about like what all the kind of things that we do, but the idea that the fact that you put forward that individual gestures are not enough for good work. So just paying somebody or doing like a robotic exchange of goods, like you said, that kind of thing. That's something that is definitely guiding our practices at the moment. As an archive, engaging with communities and trying to provide the resources that have ended up at our archive that need to come to the communities in a way that is that works well with,
right.
with what the communities need.
Right.
So this is exactly what we are aiming to do. And so that I thank you for putting this all together in such a concise format. And there's definitely some of us listening, but not enough. So
yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
I just wanted to add, when we were in Lily's class, Maths for Children Teaches Online Language, I had an example from the Yukon Native Language Center, he is going hunting.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a long discussion about that, and we analyzed the verb and everything. And when we took the verb apart, what it was is there was the roots of the tree, but the roots were facing up. And it was literally going under the forest and going to be amongst the moose. And I thought, well, why did, I'm the director of the Language Center now, but why did whoever translated that have to put he or she was going hunting.
Mm-hmm.
So just an idea I have is when linguists or whoever translates, you can still use English, but put it in that worldview.
Mm-hmm.
Why did, because we don't talk like that. It's totally against our way of being to go hunting. Like, we just don't, it's not like, So, and how beautiful it is that I am going under the cover of the forest. So, and I'm going to be under the roots of that tree to be amongst the moose, because we would never be so disrespectful as to think, even think or say or act like we would be able to kill a moose. We don't kill a moose. That moose gives itself to us. So. But what's so wrong with that translation and the damage to our worldview, because our kids are learning this stuff also. And that's reconciliation, is fixing all that.
Yeah.
Teach.
Thank you, Ashish, for your talk as well. You didn't get a chance to tell us about your picture on the last slide, so I wonder if you could tell us about this summit.
So this was a language summit in Juneau, Alaska in 2018, and it brought together nearly all of the fluent speakers of Haida, Tlingit, and Tsimshian. And this was sort of the aerial view. Some of them had to leave prior to this, and some of them couldn't make it, that sort of thing. But these are, by and large, the majority of speakers for all three of these languages and many of the learners of them. And it's an amazing photo to have all of these people all in one place, but also a scary photo for me that these are all of the speakers that for three languages that we have. Certainly, I think for Haida and Tsimshian, they're more in Canada that couldn't make it, but for Tlingit in particular, this is by and large most of them. So, but this is sort of bringing in this idea of these are language speakers and language learners, and again, at least the way I'm understanding Tlingit's understanding of building relationships with people, you can't really be outside of this frame. Like, you have to be in it. Either you're in it or you can't do the work, that sort of thing. So it's a good physical representation of that. Thank you.
And does that something in terms of like a practical thing that there's a problem with how sort of academies in predominantly white institutions have this framework of how things like MOUs and you talked about like ethical consent forms and things like that, how these tend to be positioned within Western knowledge systems. It's difficult but very important for the people who are drafting these agreements to understand that that it is possible to use slightly different ways of reaching this sort of mutual consent where where you're acknowledging everything that you just talked about. It's something that we've started to do, but it's I mean, in place, we're quite a small institution. In places like the large state universities and things like that, there's going to be a lot of resistance to that from higher up. Not necessarily, there may be a couple of people in the institution who are like, yes, this is absolutely what we need to do, and the community is like, yes, this is what we need to do. But it can often hit a roadblock when it comes to okay, but you need it in this exact wording, this exact legal wording, and so we're not going to do it unless you say this. So that's just very difficult to overcome, and I don't think there is a uniform approach.
There necessarily can't be.
You were talking about your worldview at the end of that, and that's different to other worldviews. You can't create a uniform approach. And I don't think you need to.
You presented a very well-written and very thoughtful paper, and One of the questions that I'm left with is related to what you just asked. What would you like to see instead of informed consent? Can you give us, and I know that you're not speaking for everybody, you're speaking maybe for yourself or maybe for your own community, but it would be very helpful in order to get beyond something like informed consent or the typical MOU, because an MOU is just words.
Yeah.
And informed consent is just words.
Yeah.
So if it's an issue of what other words should be there, it needs to be spoken out loud so that we can start moving towards that goal.
Yeah, I mean, so I think for me, so again, I'm a PhD student in a very large university system, and doing the work that I do in communities that I work with, again, this sort of idea of this 10-page consent form where you give them, are you okaying that I can speak to you and I can record you and this sort of thing, it sort of shuts down this relationship building in the way that I feel like it in order to do good work and be a good academic, but also just to be a good person. Like if I'm asking my mem to sign this 10-page document to talk to me, it's sort of,
because I've worked with some communities for many, many years, but because it was always a collaboration from the beginning, it wasn't really counted as research.
Yeah.
So we were both funded independently to work together.
Yeah.
So when I had to bring an informed consent form, I felt embarrassed.
Yeah, exactly.
So what do we do?
I think
we get beyond that. What do we do instead?
Like Paul? What Paul was talking about these roadblocks, it has to be a conversation with the institutional structures themselves. There's something about the institution that just does not seem to understand what we're trying to do here at this level, and it doesn't seem to understand actually how to build a relationship with Indigenous communities in an equitable way just on their own level. And the consent process, the ethics process, is very much tailored for one particular, very scientific understanding of what research is, and when you try and explain to them, well, I'm actually having a conversation and building a relationship, and that's still research, like that's still good work. It seems to be institution-wise, we need to have a conversation about what it means to do good research and what it means to be reciprocal and responsive to our Indigenous counterparts in these different ways. As far as how I think those conversations will start or how they'll go, I don't know. It's something that, having conversations like this, is the fact that I was able to come here and have a conversation like this. Things are slowly changing, but slowly. Yeah.
I think one way is to infiltrate ethics board, actually.
And
we've talked about that at UBCO. So we're part of the same system, but I'm in the smaller sister.
Yeah.
And so one thing is that I've joined the ethics board.
Oh, nice.
I was asked to, because I do research with Indigenous communities.
Okay.
So I can, rather than my Indigenous faculty, my colleagues, being tasked with trying to go in there and fight that, I'm doing it because I've worked
from the inside.
So I think infiltrating your ethics board.
Maybe that's a good suggestion.
Thank you.
Thank you.